Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. This is Justine Rotolo, also known as Miss ADD, and I want to welcome everyone to the program today. And before I get David on the phone, I want to talk a little bit about, for those of you who live in the Los Angeles area, I want to invite you to come to our adult support group. It's every Wednesday night from 7:30 to 9. It's held at the Center for Learning Unlimited in Torrance, California, 2785 Pacific Coast Highway. There's tons of growth going on at this group, and actually the person who's on the show with me today is a member of the group, and I'm sure that you will see, as we have seen before, because we've spoken to him before on the show, that he is growing and really getting in control in many ways of a lot of his negative symptoms of ADD. In addition to that, I want to remind everybody about my website, missadd.com, and on there you can purchase my book, ADD Land, The Gift of ADD. It's also on Amazon, so I would hope that you would go on and take a look at that book, because I think a lot of you will see that I look at ADD from a very positive place. And also, for those of you who are on Facebook, please go on my Facebook page, Miss ADD, and take a look at all the information, and please like it. That would be wonderful. Also, for those of you listening today and you would like to speak to either myself or David, the number to call in is 917-889-7025. And now I'm going to ask David to get on the phone.
Hi, Justine.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good. And thank you for being on the program.
My pleasure, and thank you for inviting me.
We all appreciate this. So we're going to be talking about emotional individuation and mindfulness, because without the two together, it really doesn't work. So for those of you who don't know this, maybe it's your first time listening, this is how I came up with emotional individuation. This is the walk, my own walk, that I did about 5 years ago to really get myself to a better place. I was in the middle of trauma in my life, and I recognized in the middle of that trauma that things had to change, and it wasn't people outside myself that needed to change. It was me who needed to change, and I did a lot of very difficult work to get to the place that I am today. I'm off medication. I'm in control of my negative symptoms of ADD, so I'm focused. I don't procrastinate. At least I try not to. I'm not resistant as much as I used to. I'm not judgmental the way I used to be. I have compassion for myself when things go wrong and I make mistakes. I am emotionally regulated, which was something that I was not many years ago. So that's how I came up with this emotional individuation. And there's steps involved in this process. And the first step, David will attest to, is self-awareness. And I think that possibly, David, could you speak a little bit about how self-awareness was helpful for you?
Absolutely. I totally agree with you that it is the first step. A couple of years ago, I was not self-aware, and I can admit that now. At the time, I didn't even want to confront that or admit that. I was just trying to avoid everything, trying to avoid admitting that I was ADD, and wasn't willing to really take a hard look at myself, my behavior, and my life. And as soon as I started to, I guess, surrender to the fact that I, and admit that I wasn't self-aware, that's when I think my eyes started being open, and I began to start seeing things with, of course, new eyes. And I think also it gave me a lot of hope. So I have to say, even though it was really hard for me to take a look at myself, once I started doing it, it was a real positive for me. So I think for anybody that doesn't want to take a look at their lives and doesn't want to admit that maybe they have ADD and they're not willing to admit that things just aren't working in their life, that if you do, you'll begin to see that you can change, and the first step does come from self-awareness. So how did I do that? I would say that it took the help of my wife and some other people. I think one of the simplest ways to become self-aware is to really start paying attention to people's reactions to us.
Right.
A lot of times we just don't even want to admit the fact that we're annoying people, we're pissing people off, people are upset with us, they're disappointed, they're annoyed. And the list goes on for me, and of course that brings up a lot of negative pain, because now, especially if you're the type where you tend to blame yourself, then you don't want to go there. But if you just try to, in a loving way, just acknowledge how people are reacting to you, then you begin to realize that the way you're acting, what you're doing, is not working. And you can really find the people in your life that do love you and ask them to tell you, what is it you see?
Right. And I think that's the key to this whole thing in self-awareness is, I like to describe it as, how are our behaviors affecting other people? So I was told by many people in my life that I was controlling. And I used to say, no, I'm not controlling. My father was controlling. There's no way I could be controlling, because he was. Well, yeah, when I really took a look at my behaviors and got a hold of the book, Codependent No More, I really started to see that not only was I codependent, but a lot of those codependent traits came from the controlling aspects of myself, trying to control everything around me, because I was so terrified, living in fear about how things would turn out.
I think for myself, and this is where I think it's kind of hard to, get started in self-awareness, is the fact that if you spend your life always exiting or escaping or have your mechanisms to avoid pain, you are going to have trouble becoming self-aware. And I think what also helped me was the fact that I had spent some time alone, and you have to take a little bit of time and self-reflect.
And I think there's something we spoke about before we went on the air, you and I privately, about stories that people have about their past and their life. And these are stories that they want to hold on to. They want to keep them close to their vest, because it's really their definition of who they are. And so when we carry around these stories, it's difficult when we get into the self-awareness piece to really be able to look at certain things, because if we start to get healthier and become self-aware, our story has to change.
I agree. I think the other thing I've noticed in myself, I would like to think it's universal, is the fact that when we get caught up in our story, we always think what people have done to us.
Exactly.
And if we're the victim, or we've been wronged, or we've been misunderstood, that's what we focus on. That's what's written about in our story. What we don't write, what we don't want to look at, is what we do to other people.
Exactly.
And so the hypocrisy of that is that we've hurt other people, we've disappointed other people, we've let other people down, and yet all we want to look at is what
right.
people have done to us in terms of letting us down, disappointing us, and wronging
right.
us.
So ADHD is a neurobiological disorder. It's real. Okay. There's a lot of people that will say, I'm not so sure it's real, or, it's overdiagnosed. And at times it can be, it can be mistaken for other things. But the reason I'm bringing this up is because I've had people say to me, well, how is it that you were able to get in control of your negative symptoms? Well, that had to do with neuroplasticity. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about neuroplasticity. And the easiest way for me to describe this for people who are listening, it's making new pathways in the brain. So it's like what I was talking to group on Wednesday night. It's kind of like if you had a farm and planting crops, and your whole life you planted your crops one way. There was a certain way. Now with this neuroplasticity, we're planting crops in our brain in a different direction.
So you're saying we're furrowing, we're plowing different furrows in the soil.
Exactly. And that's what the mindfulness piece does. And this is an evidence-based therapy. So for those of you who don't understand what I'm talking about here, if insurance companies are going to pay for therapy, it's got to be evidence-based. So what that says to me and to other therapists out there is that, okay, there's real change here with mindfulness. You know, it's just like therapy. Talking therapy has been proven to change the chemicals in the brain, okay? I believe that mindfulness does even more with neuroplasticity in furrowing those new pathways in the brain so that I could then be in control of my negative symptoms. Do I still have ADD? Absolutely, I have ADD. And there are times that I remind myself every day that I have it. But I am more in control of those negative symptoms because the neuroplasticity. And that's what's happening to you and everybody else in the group who is using, and my private clients, who are using this mindfulness to get better.
Okay. I'm still learning about this, still trying to understand it. How I relate to this neuroplasticity is that I'm training my brain, and I really do see that this is like brain training.
Mm-hmm.
And I relate it to athletics, and in particular, I'll use the example of swimming. You take a high-level swimmer, and now you watch the Olympics or anytime they have these underwater cameras, and you can see what these swimmers are doing exactly. And if you look at their strokes, they are biomechanically very efficient. And yet, if you take an Olympic swimmer like Michael Phelps and you compare him to
ADHD.
Okay, yeah.
Right.
Well, maybe he can
learn,
take his swimming and apply it to his training his brain the way he's trained his body. If you take like a young child, a 5-year-old, and you watch their stroke, the way their arm moves through the water is not biomechanically efficient. But through time, through good coaching and repetition and practice, and having been a swim coach back in my days of college, I observed this, dealing with kids between the ages of 5 and 18, I saw this, was that the kids do develop a better stroke. They just have to train themselves. And I know for myself, when I swam masters, even in my 40s, I would be swimming, and I was always conscious of my stroke, and I was always trying to change my stroke as I was swimming and fine-tune it to where I could swim faster and be
mm-hmm.
more efficient. And so I take that picture in my mind, and I'm trying to do the same thing with my brain. And what it's challenged me on is that I really have to work with this the same way I would get in the pool every day and
it's
swim.
It's training.
I have to train.
Yep.
And I'm just realizing that I have to love the training. And I'm admitting to you right now, I'm not quite there.
Okay.
I know that's where I need to get. And the reason I can say I don't love it because I'm not doing all the work I need to be doing.
Right.
It's sort of like I can say, hey, I like to swim, but I'm not going to practice every day. I'm not jumping in the pool. And if somebody says they love to swim and the pool's available, but they don't jump in every day and swim or train, then, well, how much do they really like it?
Right. Yes. This is like training for the Olympics. That's a good way to talk about it. So let's start off with the steps in individuation, and we did the self-awareness. Okay. So along with all these steps that we're talking about, we're continuing with the mindfulness. But let me just go to the second step. So the second step was we had a mask. Okay. And the mask was the plate, and the outside of the plate was who we project every day to the outside world. And then in the whole process of self-awareness, the backside of the plate is who we really believe that we are. So we're somebody who is anxious, has depression, procrastinates, has emotional regulation issues, but we tend to want to hide that from the outside world. Okay, so that was more along the same lines of becoming more self-aware. And what we noticed about that mask was many of us have the same mask that we wear at work and we wear at home. And that may not be the authentic person yet. There are other people who, salespeople, for example, who can be very narcissistic at work and grandiose and charismatic. And then when they come home, they can take that mask off and they can be a different person at home, more loving, you know, more authentic than they are out in the real world. So I think we learned a lot about ourselves through doing that mask at the same time.
Yeah, I like that exercise. That was helpful. The back side of the mask, what I saw was really two groups. One was my good side, the qualities and traits that I like about myself that others would affirm and say, yeah, that is kind of the authentic me. And then the negative stuff, of course, I don't want to admit, but by going through the exercise, I think it helped all of us to admit, hey, these are things I say about myself. These are things I don't like about myself. This is the honest side of me that isn't working. This is the stuff that I got to change. And so I look at that as a kind of a checklist of the things I got to work on and overcome. And the things that I want to remove and say that's how I used to be, because you can't undo the past, but I am learning to let go of the past and realize that that past behavior does not have to be my present behavior. And if I change my present behavior, because all I have is just the moment right now, as I move forward, then I'm going to have and with going back to the idea of neuroplasticity, and I'm changing my brain, then I can get rid of those old behaviors and I can furrow new behaviors.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so the mask was another very important step and also a time for sharing that I thought was very helpful in the group. So then the third step was the genogram, which I believe was probably the most powerful in terms of people really seeing things about their past, and I'm going to explain a genogram to everybody in a moment, that possibly they had never seen. So a genogram is you go through and you go back to your grandparents and you look at your grandparents and your parents and your aunts and uncles and your sisters and brothers and your cousins, and you look at the mental disorders and the substance abuse in the family. Now, mental disorder can be something as minute as ADHD, as minute as anxiety. It can be as severe as a personality disorder. You know, my father, you know, not particularly mine, but just say a person's father, you know, had narcissistic personality disorder. And there's absolutely no chance of development of self when you're the child of this person or a borderline personality disorder. So in that process, we become very tethered to these people in our lives that have these severe mental disorders. And so in looking back on that, we saw a lot of tears in the group and a lot of recognition of things that people never knew before.
Yeah, I remember people when they shared that they a lot of people, they really did their homework. They would maybe talk to some aunts and uncles or other older relatives and ask questions that they'd never asked before to kind of uncover stuff about their grandparents that they didn't know, so they could really flesh it out. I think for myself, I begin to realize that the dysfunction that's in our families can be from minor to quite severe. Some of the people had just horrific backgrounds, just a lot of either drug abuse, alcoholism, physical abuse, a lot of problems.
Sexual abuse.
Yes, and then other people, including my family, was just kind of a general craziness. I mean, people would just call them eccentric or just a little different or off kilter or kind of funny people, but you know, nothing that was malicious or real harmful. But still, there was just this underlying dysfunction, and you can trace it back to what they went through, from what country they came from and what was going on. And we see now that families that especially immigrate to America because of strife or war in their own country, suffered a lot of traumas, and these traumas then get injected
PTSD.
Injected in the family. And there's one gentleman in the group whose father fought in World War II and was, I think, fighting for the British. He was a British citizen, and he fought from 1939 to 1945, so he was there for the whole duration. And the man, when he came back from the war, for the rest of his adult life, was, you know, alcoholic and had a lot of anger. And the gentleman who shared about his father realized that he was, in talking to the family members, it became kind of revealed to him that there's other family members who talked about what he was like before he went to war and what he was like when he came back, and he was a totally different person. So before the war, he was a loving person, very gentle, kind, and didn't have a drinking problem, comes back from the war, has anger and a problem with alcohol. And that's just show a way of dealing with the trauma.
And as children growing up, we had this neurobiological disorder that back in the Stone Age nobody knew about. And we had to deal with other people in our lives that had their own issues, their own mental disorders. And as little kids, as little children, you know, we feel the need to, you know, want to take, in some way, take care of these people. And you know, that's where I think the tethering actually comes in to play. And here's a big thing. I truly believe for myself, I never felt that I was heard growing up in my family. And so part of that, for me, caused me to rage somewhat in conversation, even as a little child, when, you know, something would come up and I wasn't believed about something that I said I didn't do. I didn't feel heard. I wasn't asked, you know, how do you feel about this, or, you know, what is your opinion? And I see this across the board in our population of ADHD. A lot of people not really feeling like they were heard growing up. And that's where you get these people that will talk incessantly and many times go off on different tangents because they're so consumed with getting in what they want to say and being heard that they're not thinking about how that's affecting other people.
No, that describes me to a T. I also felt I wasn't heard and I felt misunderstood. And I think a lot of people can say that. I think my problem was it was just overly sensitive and I didn't process it right. The other thing I'm learning from what we discuss in the group and the stuff that you've been teaching us, Justine, is the fact that people that talk incessantly, and this is something I think Michael Singer talks about in The Untethered Soul, this incessant talking is a way of trying to release all this blocked up energy.
Well, and that's what we're getting to, because I was just going to bring up too, so I thank you for bringing him up. The untethered soul helps us to untether ourselves from all this stuff from the past that came up because of the things that were in our genogram. Right. So in order for that to happen, because The Untethered Soul is a very powerful book by Michael Singer, changed my life, I know it has changed yours.
I'm still in the process of having it change me because I'm just started to reread it again.
But I think that there have been things that have resonated with you that have really helped you to understand why this process is happening.
I think for people with ADD or ADHD who start reading the book, they will recognize themselves in the very first chapter.
Right. So let's then talk about the mindful piece of all this emotional individuation as we're stopping at the genogram, but we're going to continue. So there's a chapter in The Untethered Soul called The Voice Inside Your Head. And it's not schizophrenic voice, it's the thoughts that come up for all of us. So these thoughts and emotions and feelings that we have, right, I call them Taffy. Taffy, that's the name I gave, is our childhood friend, and I'm not so sure, I even Googled this, when children really develop thoughts, at what age, but I believe that this taffy follows us through our life, bringing up these thoughts in our heads.
This thought just occurred to me, because as you were speaking, I was just trying to think, at what age do I have my recollection now as I'm sitting here, my first thoughts? And I'm almost thinking that the voice inside our head that we start speaking to ourselves, it actually begins before. It begins by the voices. We start to understand speech or language, and we are taking what we're told by our parents, our caregivers, our grandparents, all the people around us, older siblings, and those are the first thoughts that we interject. So we are just almost like a recording device. We've recorded all those voices we've heard, and then we start playing those in our own head, and then we just keep on replaying them.
Well, and they become loops. My earliest memory is probably when I was 3. I can still remember back then. And I remember even back then some negative things. And, you know, so those loops play, and it's like a recording that keeps going round and round. But this taffy person who is our best friend.
Well, you said, I'm not sure if you mentioned, but taffy is T-A-F-E.
T-A-F-E, thoughts and feelings, emotions.
Right.
Okay. And taffy, if we think about taffy, saltwater taffy,
well, it's spelled
very sticky.
Yeah.
And I know it's spelled differently, but it sounds like the word.
Right.
And this is why I've decided to come up with this, because this is a way for people to remember. These are in our head. These are thoughts that don't just disappear.
We
have to choose, and we're going to go into this,
okay,
to not engage with these thoughts and
right,
to not allow them to stick in our head.
Okay, I almost picture it as like gum on the bottom of my shoe and
yeah,
going through life, and I need to scrape these
right
thoughts off my shoe so I can keep on walking through
right
life without them.
Right. So when we identify this taffy, you know, our best friend from when we were a little kid, we can actually see that these thoughts come up a lot. We ruminate a lot. I mean, I've heard this, every person I've ever worked with ADD, spoken to that has ADD, they will tell me about their ruminations. I mean, this is across the board in our population. And so when we recognize them, one of the first things I like people to do is, you know, what's more pervasive? Is it the future thoughts or is it the past thoughts? You know, because I think we want to see, are we more depressed? Are we more anxious? Because going to the past causes depression, and going to the future causes anxiety.
I think for myself, I can't say I do one more than the other. I have to say that I do both. And because those of us in our population, we tend to react to things, anything that triggers a past memory just gets us off and running with all the past thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that's put before us that is dealing with the future, somebody talking to us and saying, well, you know, when's this going to get done? What are we doing next week? What about anything that's going on in our life that is a future event? We quickly go there. I realized that my mind can quickly go from past to future to past. And
well,
back
but see,
and forth.
And that's you. And that's
right.
Great. That's you.
Oh, it's great, but that's
no.
What
I'm
I do.
What I'm trying to explain to everybody who's listening is that there are people who do ruminate more about the past.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And what I'm trying to get people to identify here is, if you wake up every day and you feel depressed, most of the time what you will see is that a lot of your thoughts are regrets.
Yes.
Oh, I did this, and I shouldn't have. I hate that word. Shouldn't have done that, you know. And those of us who have high anxiety, like the movie, we tend to live in the future, you know. Oh, my God, am I going to have enough money to pay the rent at the beginning of the month, okay? And I understand that these are all real things at times, but what I have found, and this is the biggest part of mindfulness, is being able to stay in the moment. There's peace and harmony, and it's the most wonderful place to exist.
Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah.
Because this is something that I feel I'm starting to get a handle on. I try to make it a daily practice. I also have to admit that I can go through a good portion of the day where I'm just caught up in all the other stuff that's going on. And so it is, it's like I'm realizing I really have to exercise this practice of being in the now.
Right.
So for me, I can't say that I understand fully the peacefulness, the stillness that I have had glimpses of. So I don't think it's like we hit this thing of nirvana, but I'm beginning to see that it is allowing me to stay calm. And I think we talked about this the last time I was on, and I think now I have a deeper understanding because I am doing some study and work on this, and I think you can recommend to your listeners some books to read. And then, of course, in our weekly class, we're actually doing exercises to help practice this. So for me, the mindfulness is just the understanding that the only thing I have control over, the only thing I really need to focus on is the moment right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a choice of what I'm going to do or not do right there in the moment. And if I escape into the past or I'm thinking about the future, I am not living in the real world. I'm living this imaginary life, and I've been kind of meditating on this and examining what a shame it is to, it doesn't matter if it's a rainy day or a sunny, beautiful, warm day, there's something really wonderful about being present right where you are and not to be thinking of the past or not being worrying about the future. And I think because I've developed the habit of always either being in the past or the future and living my life inside my head, that I maybe have a little further to go than other people who maybe can do it a little bit easier. But I am excited that you were being taught this. So what else could you say?
Okay,
so
let me give everybody an exercise to do, including yourself. We talked about this Wednesday night, but I don't know if I spent enough time on it. So for those of you who are listening who really don't know how to practice mindfulness, here's an exercise for you to do. So I want you to sit quietly in a quiet room. You know, shut off the TV, shut off the computer, shut off the music, and put something in front of you that you can focus on, whether that's a glass of water or it's a flower or it's a book, something that you can focus on. And while you're sitting quietly and there aren't a lot of thoughts coming up, I want you to, on purpose, bring up a negative thought. Bring up something that has been bothering you lately. Bring it up, and I want you to practice. That's your taffy that's coming up, and it's trying very hard to stick to the inside of your brain. So what I want you to practice on is releasing that thought, and the way you're going to release that thought is by focusing on that inanimate object that is in front of you. And you're going to do two things in focusing. You're going to take breaths, deep breaths, while you're focusing, because the mind can't do more than one thing at a time. And you're also going to use a mantra, because I use both. I use breath and mantra, positive mantras. The mantra here is, I'm not going to engage in that thought. I'm going to stay in the moment. That's the mantra. So I want everybody out there who struggles with mindfulness to try this, practice this, see what comes up for you. And I promise you that if you keep doing this, because this is how I really got into mindfulness and it started to work, where it became second nature for me, it can really have a powerful effect. And so all this other work that we're doing on individuation is not going to work. We're not going to be able to get in control of those negative symptoms if we're engaging in taffy. If we're allowing taffy to come up and stick inside our brains, not going to happen.
I think that's been part of my problem. I allow the negative thoughts to stick.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I'm beginning to recognize what's going on,
mm-hmm.
whereas before I just thought that was just the way I was and that's just normal thought processes and that's just the way the brain works, I am kind of excited that now I realize that isn't the way the brain has to work.
Right.
I've been talking to other people that don't have ADHD, and they explain to me that they have the ability to keep the mind quiet. There's times where they're in a task or they're just doing something, they're just sitting, and their mind is empty. It's clear. It's calm. It's quiet.
And that, for the Buddhist, is called nirvana, emptiness. The Buddhist monks, they have no thoughts. At times, they're completely empty. So let's be honest. We're not Buddhist monks.
No.
We can't walk around like that all day long.
But if I can achieve that just for moments or just to move towards that, I think that's of great value. The same way that, because for me it's such a foreign idea to actually have a quiet mind.
Right.
So people tell me they can have just empty thoughts or just no thoughts at all. And how I'd relate it, if you're in at home and your place is, everything's put away, everything has a place, everything in its place, the countertops are clean, the dishes are put away, and you don't have things piled up on the dining room table or the coffee table or the entranceway or there's not, you know, shoes on the floor in front of the front door. But everything's put away. It's like having a quiet room. And then let's say you turn off all the music and it is quiet. You don't have television going or other noise going. That's really peaceful. Just take the opposite. Now let's just have clutter everywhere. Have the TV blaring in the background, the radio going in the other room, and then any of the noise from outside coming in, that could be very distracting, really annoying, and it would probably be really hard to relax if you had all that visual and auditory clutter.
Right. So let me, and I know you know this, but let me say this to the people who are listening, and then I want to talk a little bit about your struggles, okay? So in being every day for me, in being in the moment, and believe me, I have two sons who live up in San Francisco, and they both struggle not only with ADHD, but my older son is bipolar too. My younger son is on the autistic spectrum and struggles a lot with anxiety. So I have a lot of thoughts that could come in every day about their well-being. When those thoughts come up, I say to myself, oh, this is fascinating, but I can't go there right now because I need to be in the moment and focus on what I need to get done. This is a big piece of getting in control of that one negative symptom, inattention. Okay? Attention deficit disorder is the inability to focus and attend when we need to. Not true with neuroplasticity and mindfulness for me. So if I'm in the moment and doing something that I need to get done that takes a lot of attention and a lot of thought process, I cannot start ruminating about my son's bipolar. If I do that, I don't get anything done. So I am able then, without sitting quietly and practicing, because I've done this work, I've done the practicing, and I did it day after day after day till it became second nature. So now, having ADHD, I'm one of those people who can be empty. I am empty many times during the day. Now, are there times when I still struggle with this? Absolutely, because I'm a human being. But when those days come up, because I'm very stressed for one reason or another, I give myself a lot of compassion, which is all part of, you know, the mindfulness piece, which we're going to talk about, and I move on. So I don't ruminate about making a mistake. I give myself compassion because I'm a human being. I made a mistake. And I move on to the next level here. And this is why I'm so passionate. I'm sure people are hearing my passion in my voice and talking about this, because there is a way out. There is a way out for everybody to get to use our creativity. We are the most creative population in the world. We are an elite population. We're out-of-the-box thinkers. I have a book that has hundreds of people in that book who are successful, incredible people with the gift of ADD.
I, on the other hand, I'm not in complete control of my negative symptoms. I do have an inability to focus and to attend to the task at hand. I'm still ruminating. I hear what you're saying, and I feel I'm doing the work. I think, especially this past week, I'm realizing I haven't been working hard enough.
Right.
And instead, in the past, where I would have got frustrated, would have beat myself up, I just admitted it. Said, look, you're not working hard enough.
Right.
So I was able to get in the moment and say, okay, well, then let's get to work.
Right. So let's talk about something.
Okay.
So last week, and I really, really like David's wife. She's a very lovely person who is very accepting of David's ADD. And she's also very happy to do what she can to help. She's not critical like she used to be, okay? She's really come around. And so I got a phone call from her last week after one of our coaching sessions, and she was saying, I see all the tools that you're giving to David, and I'm getting a little depressed myself because there's still piles around the house. Now, I've spoken about piles before, and for those of you listening, piles, there's fear in all our piles. I don't care how many you have, even if you have one, there's fear in that pile. And I discovered this years ago myself when I would have three or four different piles and I'd be looking at them, and then I'd say, well, wait a minute, why is it that I can't get through these piles? Well, maybe there was a piece of paper in that pile that needed to be addressed that maybe I didn't really know what to do with. And so that was a fear. Okay, so let's talk about your piles that you and I waited till today really to talk about.
Okay. I don't think I really wanted to talk about this, but I know I need to. I want to get rid of my piles. I have to say, I don't really understand why I still have them.
Okay.
Why I can...
Do you see the fear in them?
Oh, yeah. I think what it is that there is work associated with it. There's nothing wrong with work. It's just time and effort. But for some reason, and this deals with not having clarity of mind and not being able to really stay in the moment and understand that you have the power of choice at every moment and just make a decision. Sometimes, you know, if you want to make a perfect decision, you're going to wait forever until everything comes together.
But there's no such thing as perfection.
I know. So what I'm learning to do is to, and I know this, so I just have to remind myself, is the fact that the moment is now. Make a decision. You've got a list of things to do. Just pick one and do it. And instead, I will ruminate and I'll worry that this has got to get done and this and this other thing and these. So all of a sudden, there's three or four things that need to get done. And they, of course, all need to get done now. And that, of course, is ridiculous because is that really true?
No.
No. But you somehow think that way. And so now you paralyze yourself. You do nothing.
But let me show you something.
Oh, we say one thing. The other thing is that I look at the pile as this monolith. Instead of looking at it, most piles have they're stacks of paper. You deal one paper at a time, and I forget that.
You're engaging with Taffy.
Oh, yeah.
And looking at those piles.
I'm spending a lot of work with my thoughts, feelings, and emotions.
Right.
And not with the task at hand.
Right.
And that's...
And if you could just kind of say... We'll see you later, Taffy, because I'm not doing this.
I need to practice that.
Right.
I think that with the lesson I'm learning is to, when you have a task in front of you, and all of a sudden, instead of just doing the task, you see between you and the task is all these thoughts, feelings, and emotions. That should be the recognition, like the red light goes on that says, hey, you're putting thoughts, feelings, and emotions in front of the task. Let's let them go, push them aside, and that I'm learning to do. It really isn't that hard to push your thoughts out. And I guess the way I would look at it is if somebody would tell me either something to do or not do, the mind's real powerful. If you tell people, you know, think of a pink elephant, you'll think of a pink elephant. And if you tell them, don't think of a pink elephant, you'll still think of a pink elephant. So.
Right.
All I'm doing is recognizing the thought and then introducing a new thought real quickly. And that thought is an action, is to go and pick up the first piece of paper. You told me last week, and I am trying to do this, is the idea of, and correct me if I don't have this right, that part of the way of getting putting aside the thoughts, feelings, and emotions is to be in motion. Do you call it flow, or what? Can you describe that? Where I'm supposed to get moving?
Yes, you're supposed to get up and get moving. Okay, so what I found myself is when my mind would tell me to procrastinate something, to break that period that I'm in, to break that, I guess, cycle, you could say, that I'm in, I would stand up, shake it off, and start walking around. And then come back and say, mantra, no, I got to get this done. This is what I said I was going to do today, and this is what I'm going to do. And the other thing we talked about the other night is taking the most difficult thing and putting that on the top of the list. Because many of us tend to want to do the easy things first. And then we keep moving that list from day to day to day, and the difficult thing never gets done.
Yeah, and typically the most difficult thing is the most important.
Right. So let's talk about the piles for a minute. Yeah. Because one of the things I think you and I have talked about before, and if we haven't, my fault, but we need to break stuff down. Because when we look at, say, 10 piles of stuff that we have to take care of, that's overwhelming. And the minute we get overwhelmed, it's not lazy, I hate that word, it's overwhelmed, we shut down.
Yeah, I do that.
Okay. So what you want to do is you're going to tell yourself for tomorrow, I'm going to go through one pile. That's the first thing on my list in the morning before I do anything else. And if that means you have to get up an hour earlier, so be it. But that is the first thing you're going to do after breakfast, is you're going to tackle that one pile. Just look at it as one.
I'm trying to even break it down further. I tend to, again, as I said earlier, make a problem bigger than it is. And I can handle one piece of paper, and that's why I'm breaking it down. Because that's the other thing that I have to admit, until I really started working on this, that I approach projects as just this one big, huge task, and forgot the common sense notion that a large project can easily be broken down into smaller tasks.
Right. Exactly. Look, to look at it, excuse me, as one, looking at one piece of paper isn't going to put a dent in it at all. Okay. So this is why I'm saying.
Okay, help me here.
If you have 10 piles of papers around, you need to tackle one pile tomorrow.
Okay.
Okay? And even if you skip the next day and go to the third day and tackle the next pile, you're moving on. Look, part of the reason we don't tackle the piles is, as I said before, related to fear. And a lot of that fear, for a lot of people, I don't know if you're one of these people, I'm not sure I ever asked you this question, but for a lot of people, they have a hard time throwing things out. This is an anxiety disorder.
Oh, I've been guilty of that.
Okay.
I've gotten better through the years. I can throw things out. I'm very deliberate when I do so. But it was only as part of my self-awareness work that I realized that I attach a lot of emotion to paper. And it's either paper that, in many cases, and this is the problem with work piles, your own personal papers, is the fact that there's unfinished tasks, things that you procrastinated on, things that maybe aren't that important, but you've made them important.
Okay, so this is good. So in my inbox, in my computer, it's clean every day because I have folders that I put things in. I move things to folders. So I never get overwhelmed when I open my computer by tons of emails because they're all gone. I just have today's emails to deal with. But I hold on to some, and it's interesting. I hold on because I may need that, and I don't have a particular folder for it to go to. And what I began to realize is that after a while, I can just really delete them. Because after holding on to them for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, what am I doing? What do I need this for? I really don't need it. So that's when you're looking at these papers that you might have been holding on to because there's a job in here that needs to get done or there's something. You haven't done it in a month or two. What do you need to do it for?
This makes me think of one type of paperwork that a lot of people have a lot of fear with, and they're afraid to let go of it, and that is all our tax papers and our receipts. And it's almost like the IRS, I just got to poke fun, they've got us all, especially for the ADD population, they have given us an extra worry, an extra fear that we're already like to hang on to paper anyway. And now we're afraid if we throw this piece of paper away and we ever get audited, we're going to get screwed because we're going to have an expense that is going to be disallowed because we threw the piece of paper out. So we hang on to that.
Okay. So here's what you do. If you have that kind of fear, you get a folder. That's your fear folder.
Okay, I like that.
Okay, your fear folder, and put your pieces of paper in there that are causing you fear that you don't have to deal with today, and file it.
Okay.
And you know it's there. So you know now you have a fear folder.
Well, I think I might have a fear box.
I'm sure you do. But this way we're moving stuff around and we're getting things done, and it's not like we continually every day come in and look at these piles on the floor, on the desk, or wherever they are, that really are not conducive to our life at all.
I also like this idea because now this is a way of me admitting that I have a fear.
Yeah.
Instead of just ignoring it or not even be able to put a name on it. Because, you know, it's like it's just the mechanical thing people have with papers. You need to file stuff, but you don't know what label to put on the file folder. And I think that I have papers that I have to deal with.
Right.
And I haven't wanted to deal with them because I didn't know what to put, how to label it. And what you've done here is just show me that this is the fear folder.
Fear folder.
I like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So now let's talk a little bit about something that causes this population a lot of issues, time. Okay? So, for example, I had a client this morning who was supposed to be to me at 2 o'clock this afternoon, excuse me. And at 2 o'clock, he texted me and said, I'm 5 minutes away. And I thought, no, you're not. Because anybody who's ADD who tells me they're 5 minutes away, I know they're 20 minutes away. Okay? Sure enough, 2:20, he comes walking through the door. And I started laughing. He said, what are you laughing about? I go, you're not in touch with time. I've lived this with my son for years. I lived it with myself for years. I know how this feels. So let me help you with this. Okay. You have to really try and be realistic about what you're doing. So here's how you do this. When you do your file folder tomorrow, you set a timer. Just see how long it takes.
Okay. So when you say set a timer...
I'm doing
one pile, you're saying, right?
Right.
Okay, one pile.
Start the timer at zero.
Do I have a goal in mind?
No.
Just
we want to see how long this takes.
Because I know I can start ruminating and daydreaming. I can spend all day on that one pile. So how about if I say I'm going to see how long it takes, but I'm really going to work at trying to be mindful and in the moment.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's what I would.
Okay, remember.
Hello. It's what we're working on.
Yeah, I know, but these are new skills here. This is
okay.
New practices.
Okay, so, be mindful. Let's be mindful. Let's be aware. Let's not engage with taffy tomorrow.
Okay.
And let's see by setting your timer at zero and let it keep running, let's just see how long this is going to take. Because here's the thing.
Can I also inject this? Can I also kind of make it a game? Because, you know, And so I'm not going to race, but I'm really going to try to say, hey, let's see if I can do this quickly.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the reason I'm doing this is because I think many of us, and you're much better than you used to be because you're on time when you show up to me. You're not late. Many of us get so lost in our head that we're not aware of time.
Oh, absolutely.
At all. So what I do with other people is when we talk about getting something done, I say don't do tasks. Do it by time. So for example, I've got this to do. You got 2 hours to do that.
Okay, but what helps me is it's just amazing. I never if I did this in my youth, I did it inadvertently and and unconsciously. But what I'm trying to do now in a conscious way is, instead of saying I'm going to spend an hour on something, I'm looking at what time do I want to have something done by, and then I work backwards. The same way, what is enabling me?
I do that too.
Well, I never used to. This is all new for me. This shows the stupidity of how I was living my life. But if I have to be somewhere, I take myself in my mind to the time in that place, and then I'm like, it's almost like I'm driving backwards. And when I have to actually be in my car, when I have to walk out the door, when I actually, you know, when you got to like brush your teeth, comb your hair, do all this.
That's what I taught at group one night.
Right.
That when I know I have to walk out the door at 7:30 in the morning, I have to be in the shower at 6:30. And I have to be already done with breakfast. I have already looked at my emails. I've already done anything else. I'm in the shower at 6:30. I'm getting dressed. I'm out the door at 7:30.
Okay, but just to show you that I have a ways to go, in preparing to show up on time today, so which meant I had to be here early.
And you were.
I had it all kind of planned out. I also had some work earlier in the day. I was able to complete that on time. So I had also pre-planned that job that I made sure that I was going to be done in time to get to where I needed to be so I could be on your podcast for today. However, I actually was a little bit early, had a little extra time, and I was fighting this on the inside. There was just a few, because I was actually had a little extra time, okay? So I wasn't down to the wire, and I'm thinking, you know, I think I got a little time to do a little bit more. And in the past, I would have engaged, would have lost time, and I would have showed up late. But today, I kind of observed what my mind was doing, and I recognized, I said, oh, you're going to add a task here, huh? And this task is not a two-minute task.
Right.
I could probably spend an hour on it.
Right.
So all I was going to do is do a small bit of it. So I'm really pleased with myself that I just said no. As much as you'd like to get this done, you ain't doing it now. Get out the door.
Right. See, and that's the whole thing. Many of us will start to get ready and then exit. Oh, I just want to go look at this for a minute, or maybe I just want to go water my plants. And see, that's what we do. We tend to exit all over the place instead of staying, not engaging with Taffy and staying focused on what it is that's in front of us in the moment, getting dressed and getting out the door.
But it's also with a goal in mind, because when you say what's in front of us, because I get easily distracted, you're seeing, oh, no, I got to put that away. I mean, even if something is emptying the dishwasher.
No. When I say what's in front of us, I mean getting out the door. I don't mean what's physically in front of us.
But you brought up a great point. I think for me, what's in front of us should be the goal in mind.
Right.
However, I think my way of thinking, what's in front of me is what's in front of me.
Right.
And that the goal, and I'm really not saying – so I guess I'm struggling with this, and I need some clarity, and I guess I need to figure out, develop some tools. Maybe you can help me get some tools to where I can do this. It is really easy for me to have a goal in mind, start working on something, and then get distracted, and then the goal is just, it's got all these other little things in front of me that come, because the thoughts, feelings, and emotions that get between me and my goal. And so,
but you're choosing... And here's the tool.
Okay.
You're choosing to engage
there.
With Taffy.
And that's, okay, you brought up a great point. I think for me, what has always made it hard for me to stay focused on goals is that I never recognize this, so I can kind of picture this in my mind, that I'm seeing the thoughts, feelings, emotions, like physically, like right in front, like in my face, like somebody like putting their hand in your face, making it hard for you to see where you want to go. And so it's the same way if you're trying to do something and somebody's annoying you and they're putting their hand in your face, you say, hey, get your hand out of the way. I can't see what I'm doing. And I think that's what I'm doing, is I can't see what I'm supposed to be doing, what I want to do, what I should do, what's really going to make me happy, because I'm allowing like a hand getting put in front of my face, my thoughts, feeling, and emotions.
Taffy's getting in there.
Right.
And you're allowing that to happen.
So I can just say, get the hand out of the face. I can't see what I'm doing.
Right. And I'm going to stay in the moment, and I'm going to continue to move forward. Move forward, meaning this goal, this project, this pile of crap that I have to go through because it's all full of fear.
Right.
I'm going to get through it.
Okay. You know something, because I can see, I can picture this one room right there in the corner on the floor. There's
right.
a pile. I can picture it. And I think the reason why I can walk through that room and not see it is because I have all these thoughts, feelings, and emotions that are keeping me from seeing the pile. And it's also preventing me from attacking that pile and say, let's get it done. Let's put it away. And I've learned this is simple, basic organizational skills that for people who don't have ADD, it's like, duh, it's simple. But in our population, it's like, we're having trouble. I can't do this. And that is the thought that a pile, you can do one of three things with it. You're either going to throw it out, you're going to file and keep it in a proper spot, or you're going to give it to somebody else.
Right. So let me tell you what I used to do when I had piles, okay? And this is good for people who are listening. So I would get a garbage bag, and I would get file folders, okay? And I'd start going through the papers, and the paper would either be thrown in the garbage or shredded, okay, when this was before shredders. And or I made a new file for the paper, okay? If you want to call it a fear file, that's fine. But there are certain things in those piles that need to be made a file for that you can file away.
What about stuff that you really need to deal with? It isn't just filing it like we're keeping record keeping. You got to act on it.
That's a whole nother file, okay? And I thank you for bringing that up, because that file for me would be act on immediately. So that was a file, because see, here's what happens. If we stop in the middle of going through that pile because, oh, my God, I have to act on this, start acting on that, and the rest of what we're doing doesn't get done. So if you have a fear file and an act-upon file immediately, and then other files that are okay to file, as soon as you're done with the pile, the act-upon immediately, you go through and you do what you need to do with those. You don't let the day go by Taffy telling you, oh, look what you did. You got through this pile. You're done. No, you're not.
Yeah, because I got to act on this stuff. Like, here's the other thing we talked about the other day. It's real easy for me, because when you procrastinate, tasks really do pile up. And so I can easily come up with 20 tasks to do. And they can be some real simple things, even some household chores, you know. You have something in a drawer that's broken, you got to glue it, you got to get something mended, you got to drop something off at the dry cleaners. I think in our population, like, everything's important. And, of course, that's not true. But everything is a task that has to be done. So it's really easy for me to write down 20 things that sure would be nice to get them all done. And you told me the other day, and I've been really thinking about this, and it's really given me a lot of relief, is the idea that in a good day, still putting in a good work day,
six.
The most you can do is six.
Right.
And, you know, I have to tell you, that gave me such relief.
Yeah.
Because before, I was just beating myself up, like, can't I get anything done? And now I'm just shooting for six, and that's doable.
Right.
So if I can get seven or eight, that's a bonus.
Right. And, you know, when you have these things that come up during the day that you have to do, you have to cluster them together.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Okay, so for example, if these are, let's say that out of the six things, three of them are go to the cleaners, go to the grocery store, and go to the post office, okay? So you do those three together. A lot of people will go to the post office and come home, and then go to the cleaners and come home. Do those three together. So this way, it gives you time to get out in the fresh air. You're outside. You try to time it. Be aware of how long this is taking you, or time yourself. Like when I go out to do an errand, I'll say, I'm always looking at the clock. I'm a big time person. And I'll say, okay, I got to go to two stores. It's going to take me 45 minutes and I'm going to be done. So that means when I walk into JCPenney, because I go to Sephora at JCPenney, I can't stop and look at clothes. Because I have to go to Sephora, get the makeup, and get out of there. Now, that saves time and money all in one thing, because I'm not looking at clothes, or I'm not looking to choose.
Okay. Well, see, women, they love to go out and shop. I'm
no,
not speaking,
that
okay.
You're not talking to a woman who loves to
okay.
go out and
my
shop.
My wife, however, is okay. quite, only you could call her a professional shopper.
Okay.
I think what I'm hearing you say, and I think I'm just giving maybe the way I am, and I think maybe a lot of men are this way, and for me to be mindful of time, sometimes I'll have those three chores, the grocery store, the post office, and dry cleaners. And what I'm learning to do is to say, you know, like all this other stuff you need to do, I only have time to do two. I'm not going to do all three, even though it kind of makes sense to do a big loop. I'm just going to do, because the other thing, the dry cleaners, that can wait till the end of the week. So it's just slowly but surely learning how to prioritize, not making everything important, and then weighing it out. Because if I'm going, making an extra stop or two extra stops, it means there's other stuff I'm not getting done. So I agree with you, dude. The idea of going somewhere, coming home, and then later in the day, going somewhere and coming home, that makes no sense.
No.
It does make sense to group things.
So I want to get back on track, but let me just kind of sum up something here, okay, because I think this is important. Again, the time thing, mindfulness. If we're in the moment and we're cognizant, aware of what time it is, and what we need to do, we can back into how much time this is going to take. Now, a lot of people say, you're one of the people that bought into my backing into. There are people who can't do that. They don't feel comfortable with that. They can't say to themselves, okay, in order to get out of the house at 7:30, I got to get in the shower at 6:30. I get it. Everybody's different. Just because it works for me doesn't mean it's going to work for everybody else. No matter what works, we have to be aware of time.
Right. So I think just give people a choice. I've just found that working backwards really helps me a lot better than moving forward.
Right.
Because I tried doing it moving forward, and I was so easily to get derailed. And I think I'm realizing I have to really keep the end in mind.
Right. Now, here's something that I do that I'm sure people will laugh at. I think it's pretty funny because I can laugh at myself all the time. So my clock in the car is 40 minutes fast. Okay?
Okay. Yeah.
And have you ever, in the whole time you've known me, seen me late?
No, and the times that I show up extremely early, you're still there.
Okay. So that 40 minutes ahead of time,
okay.
for some reason,
okay.
in my ADD mind, works beautifully.
So that is the correct time. So whatever that time is, on that clock, that means if I have to be somewhere at 5, when I drive up and it's maybe a couple minutes before 5, and I'm on time, when, of course, with the rest of the world, you're actually 40 minutes early.
Exactly.
Wow.
No, I'm not. Here's what it is. So in order to be, if I have to be at my office at 5, my clock says 5:40 in the car.
So wait, so you show up at 5:40?
I don't show up 40 minutes earlier. I'm just saying...
Well, wait, 40, no, it would say 4, if it's 40 minutes fast, it would say 4:20.
4:40. Okay. So, okay, wait.
Wait. If you have to be, if it's 40 minutes fast?
Yeah.
So it goes ahead. So if the clock says 5, it's really just go back 40 minutes. It's only 4:20.
No, listen.
I'm not understanding.
Let me explain it to you. If it's 5 o'clock, my car clock says 5:40. So when I leave in the morning, my clock is 40 minutes ahead of where. So in other words.
I misunderstood. You're right.
Yes.
So
it works for me. All I'm saying is I've never been late. I really have never been late. There was one time that I was late this entire year, and it was for a client to meet them at a lawyer's office, and my GPS got all screwed up and ended up taking me to another address. The difference of crossing over 190th and not. People don't know who I'm talking about, but this is out in California. And I was late, and I wanted to die because I was 15 minutes late. But for some reason, setting my clock 40 minutes early helps me to always be on time.
Okay, so... maybe I got all
40 minutes late. Didn't mean to say early.
Okay.
So in other words, if it's truly 5 o'clock...
Your clock says 5:40?
Exactly. Yeah. So it works for me. That doesn't mean anybody else who's listening kidding. Although I will tell you, my son is so funny. He says, I do this all the time. So it must be in the DNA.
It must be. Because that for me, I'd be doing all these mental calculations.
Yeah.
I think what works for me is I want an accurate time.
Right.
And then what I need is, because again, it just all has to do with making the right decisions, is telling myself what I'm going to do at a set time. And if I know the time's accurate, I really have one less thing to worry about. If I know the time's accurate, because invariably most of us, if we have clocks around the house, one clock's a couple minutes fast, one's a couple minutes slow, and then at least for me, I have to remember which one's fast, which one's slow, which one's accurate, and that just gets me too much work.
Right.
And so I try to keep them in sync.
And that's now in my house, they're all correct. So it's very interesting, but that's my crazy mind.
Well, Justine, let me in a positive way ruminate on that or meditate.
I just think it's pretty fascinating. Anyway.
Okay.
Let's go on here because I want to get into, so we did the self-awareness, we did the mask, we did the genogram, and one of the things that we incorporate in all this is mindfulness. So we did some talking about mindfulness.
Right.
Okay.
I think that's one of the most powerful things that I've learned in the past year.
So what we want to do now is talk a little bit about the letter that I know you're trying to get to. Okay.
Yeah, I know we're doing a lot of really other great stuff, and so I've kind of been focusing on that. And I don't know if it needs to be part of our discussion today, but I think for the audience, I'm sure they're going to ask this question. But the question in my mind is, when should I start writing the letter? When does the person know that, hey, now's the time to start writing the letter?
Well, I think that when you are growing in the process, so you've done the genogram, you're aware of the things that you were tethered to in the past, and especially as a young child, things that have happened to you that might have stopped you from emotionally individuating, growing up emotionally. That's what that means. Because
right.
Many of us in this population, and I've spoken to so many people who have said, I'm not an adult. My wife or my husband will say, I feel like I have 3 kids when they only have 2. Okay. So we want to get to that place where I got to, and this is the other reason why I'm in control of my negative symptoms, is because I'm now an adult. So I take full responsibility, and that's a big key, for all of my behaviors, for everything that happens, and I wanted that change. So I wrote the letter to the little child inside of me who went through a lot as a child. I went through a lot as a child. And in doing the genogram and in really getting in touch with situations in my own family and outside my family that occurred and things that happened, I was able to write the letter, and I wrote it in the third person, like speaking to the child and me at the same time. So saying, I'm so sorry for everything that you went through, being specific. It was probably about a 12 or 13 page letter. Read it to one other person, the person that I was working with at the time that was helping me through this period in my life, and then I ripped it up and I threw it out. And it was so amazing because the next day I felt like I was an adult and I hadn't felt that way. And I knew that a lot of things that happened in my life was because of me being this non-individuated child. Okay. What I've heard from other people in the group who have written this letter already, that what's happening is they feel more adult-like after writing the letter. And so the change that's occurring now is occurring quickly because of feeling more adult-like. Okay. So that's a piece of it that possibly you have to take on.
So I know there's a lot of other great stuff we're working on in the group, and then you're also helping me individually. I guess this is kind of a personal question. Maybe if it's beneficial for your audience, we can talk about it. Otherwise, we can talk about other items. Do you think, based on the stuff we've talked about today and where I'm at, should I start writing the letter? Or?
Yes, I do.
Okay, then that's something
I really do, because I think that you've done a lot of work on yourself, and you've really come in so many ways a long way, and this is the next subject we're going to talk about, where your growth has really been powerful And I think it's time for you to write this letter. And your growth has been powerful in being able to really look at your maladaptive schemas. And this is something I want to share with everybody out there. You actually can go online and look up the 18 early maladaptive schemas, and it was actually a therapist by the name of Jeffrey Young who came up with these. And these schemas that I found were in the book called Disarming the Narcissist, because I was working with somebody who was narcissistic. And when I saw these, it wasn't – these schemas are not related to the narcissist. They're related to everybody in life that come up with situations that can cause these. So here's what a schema is, for those of you who don't know. It's a collection of thoughts that happen either early in our childhood or in adolescence that we hold on to, and it kind of defines and makes up who we are. So I just want to read one in particular that I see is pervasive in our population. And this one is the fourth one, and it's called defectiveness/shame, the feeling that you are defective, bad, unwanted, inferior, or invalid in important respects, or that you would be unlovable to significant others if exposed, may involve hypersensitivity to criticism, rejection, and blame, self-consciousness, comparisons, and insecurity around others, or a sense of shame regarding your perceived flaws. These flaws may be private, for example, selfishness, angry impulses, or unacceptable sexual desires, or public, such as undesirable physical appearance or social awkwardness. So I find across the board that in our population, this one kind of stands out. And, of course, there are others that, you know, many others that people checked. And so then what we're working on right now in group, for those of you who are listening, in advanced mindfulness, we do a lot of work with compassion for ourselves, for things that we've been through in our life and mistakes that we have made, and judgments, so being judgmental. And ultimately, what we're finding out in the work that we're doing is many of the judgments that we make about others are related to these maladaptive schemas, so they come back to ourselves. And the more powerful the criticism or judgment, the more it's related back to you. And so in being able to identify these things is how we ultimately are able to release this pain. We can run this pain through our heart, as Michael Singer talks about in his book in Chapter 11, Pain, the Price of Freedom. So what you've been doing really good work on, David, is being able to recognize things from your past and your childhood that have caused you a lot of possible shame and guilt and feelings of not being probably nurtured the right way or cared for the right way. Some of the things you talk about is how your mom, and she's a good woman, but she didn't know any better, and how she handled you when you were growing up. And you're looking at this, and it's painful. It's not easy to really go through all this, but this is what's helping you to be able to release this so that when something happens, and your stuff, as we call it, gets hit, related to these schemas or other things that have come up in your life, you can then say and not engage in taffy, oh, I know what this is. I can deal with this. This is great. Okay, this is fascinating. It's my favorite word. I'm just going to let this go and move on with my day.
I hear what you're saying, and as I understand it now, and other authors write about this, is the idea that anytime something really upsets us in a like an immediate, visceral sort of way, it really has nothing to do with what's going on in that particular moment.
Yeah.
It's stuff from our past.
Exactly.
Because what I'm beginning to understand is that I'm beginning to recognize there are things that don't bother me at all.
Right.
And other things that bother me to a tremendous degree. And yet if we examine ourselves and then we take our observations of other people, we find there's other people, we're just the opposite. Certain things that don't bother us bother them and vice versa. So obviously the things that bother us as human beings are very unique, and so it still points back to the fact it's not about what's going on right now, it's in our past. And then as you bring up the idea of the schema, I'm going through them and realizing I have a number of them. So I'm just in the process of cataloging them and using them, that when things bother me, I take that as like a red light goes off and I recognize, hey, something's getting hit. Let's take a look at it from a dispassionate point of view and let's not get wrapped up in it. Let's step aside and let's look at this and let's examine what this really is all about, because it's not about what's going on right now.
No.
And the other thing that's beautiful, I have to say, is there certain things that don't bother me now that a year ago would have bothered me a lot.
Right. And so I see that.
I'm real happy
about
that.
And I see that you're regulating your emotions a lot better, and that's where this work, when people talk about, well, you know, ask me, how can I regulate my emotions? Well, this work is really important in that area.
Yeah, I can say, because a lot of times this part of me beating myself up is saying, you're not working hard enough, you're not getting enough done, you're not where you need to be, and gosh, you should be further along. And I'm just like, wait a minute, just knock it off. Let
right.
it go. But I can say, especially with my wife, I think it's with our spouses that, you know, a stranger could say something like, yeah, whatever, but if our wife or husband says something to us, it can really affect us. And even this morning, we had a conversation, you brought something up, I could see something come up, and it didn't bother me like it would have a year ago. I would have totally reacted. We would have been off to the races and having an argument, and today we didn't.
So, I mean, I think that we all can benefit from looking at these schemas that we have from our childhood, from our adolescence, these combination of different thoughts that come up. And as soon as we deal with them and we're able to release them, then as they come up and they get hit, it still comes up, but it's released. So it's like, okay, I know what that is. I can deal with that.
The corollary, and there's not a right word, but what is related to this, things that I can let go of, they don't bother me anymore. The energy's released. I now am noticing I have less of a need to talk about it. And it goes back to the beginning of our conversation that my loquaciousness as a child really was just trying to deal with all the energy that was bottled up inside of me, wasn't being released. And as I'm bit by bit releasing stuff, I can be more quiet in my conversations with other people, and they don't have to hear my incessant chattering.
Because for the first time in your life, you're being heard.
Wait, let me ask you, because it's almost like I'm listening to myself.
That's what I mean.
Because it's not that other people, whether they listen or not.
Well, that's what I mean. You're being heard internally. In dealing with these things, your psyche is getting filled up in a positive way. You're being heard. You're giving yourself positive affirmation for things that you went through, and that's why you don't need to talk about them.
Right, and now I can, in a conscious, volitional way, I make decision, I'm going to let go of this.
Yes.
I don't need to be chained to this anymore. This is my past, and that's where it belongs. And this is where I think I understand the power of the now, the moment, and being mindful in the moment is the fact that what happened to me yesterday, all the emotions, good or bad, but typically it's the bad ones, I don't need to take a bad experience from the day before with all the bad emotions that went with it, all the reacting, that gosh, I was dealing with stuff that goes further back in my past, because what upset me yesterday really wasn't what happened yesterday. It was hitting stuff from earlier.
Right.
There's no need for me today to allow yesterday's bad feelings to come in today. And so I can now see that clearly. And the best example I can give you is once with my wife, we were having an outing on a beautiful Saturday. in a community in Southern California that we don't normally travel to. And we're walking around, and it's just beautiful. A lot of people are out there. We're near the beach. And the day before was really a terrible day because I had some dealings with a really irrational person who just has his own problems and tried to make them mine. And so it was a real miserable experience. And as I'm walking with my wife, the thoughts of what happened the day before kept on popping up. And it was really ruining my wonderful day with my wife. And I finally caught myself. I said, look at this, man. It's a great, wonderful day. And this jerk from yesterday. And, of course, remember, now I'm also learning it has to do with how I reacted to him, too. So
it was probably some of your stuff.
Absolutely. So I'm not an innocent party in the whole day because it takes two to create an argument. And I finally just said, look, I don't need to bring yesterday into today to ruin today. Yesterday belongs yesterday. Now the past, I'm going to be in the moment, I'm going to enjoy today. And for the rest of the day, I really had a wonderful day.
Which is great.
But in a way, it was kind of a great lesson to have place. I would like to be able to, and I think I'm moving this direction, I'll be able to go forward, I'll be able to have a great day, and yesterday or the week before or a year before is not going to pop in and ruin today.
Right. See, and I think that's the most powerful thing about mindfulness and, and emotional individuation, and the two of them together, growing up, becoming an adult, because if you don't go through that process with the mindfulness, somehow the mindfulness doesn't seem to get through, especially in the ADD population. The neuroplasticity is huge, how our brain paths can be hollowed out and changed, and we do things differently than ever before.
You know, as we've been talking today, I can see more clearly how, I guess, my brain is, I'm furrowing some new neural pathways. I really wish, though, that it was much more, it was a clear thing where you could actually see it more clearly. And I guess it really doesn't happen that way.
Well, let me just say this, and this is for you and for other people that are listening. It took us years, to get to this place that we're at, okay? For me, it was 5 years ago. In the past 5 years, I've grown tremendously, and my brain, the whole chemistry of my brain is different than it ever was before. I mean, I'm just so much better. Neuroplasticity takes time, and it's going to take a little bit more time, but I can see the difference that you've made already, because I step back from you and I know you. And so I'm able to see the growth that you're experiencing. But to get to that place where, things are really clicking all the time very well, most of the time, that takes a little bit longer because you have to use this mindfulness all the time for neuroplasticity to happen and for change to occur. You have to use it.
I think, and how I'm summing things up is that it's a daily practice.
Yes.
And the same way, if you want to get results physically, if you want
to
get back in
gotta
shape.
Got to go to the gym.
Got to go to the gym.
Here and eat
I've
right.
I got to do the exercises.
Right.
And what we've talked about today is a lot of great exercises.
Yes.
Suggesting, I want to thank you for today.
Thank you, David. I really appreciate you being here. It's went by. This time goes by so fast. I know you're going to come back because we're going to keep talking about your growth. And for everybody who's listening, I hope all of you will take the time to listen to this podcast again, even if you are listening live now, because there's a lot of things that you need to do in order for that neuroplasticity to help you get to that change. Contact me if you have any questions. You can contact me on my website. My phone number's on there. Excuse me, or through my Facebook page, Miss ADD. So again, I want to thank everybody. Next week, Alan Brown is back, and Alan is the founder of ADD Crusher, and he's going to be talking some more about the Zen hacks. So I'm looking forward to having him back on the show. So I hope everybody listens in. Have a wonderful Sunday. Enjoy the moment. and I will see you next week.